Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. Thank you for joining us today for our conversation about water quality. Earlier in the show, talking about PFAS contamination out by the airport in La Crosse, out on French Island, town of Campbell. And grateful for those guests who shared their time with us today. Now we're turning our attention toward other parts of our listening area. And what are the issues facing water quality and those concerned with water quality in those areas? Joining me are representatives of two different organizations. We've got Tom Lukens from the Valley Stewardship Network, which is based in Viroqua and serves Vernon County, surrounding area. Tom, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, yeah, thank you. Valley Stewardship Network's an organization that's been around for 21 years now and started off with community conversations and what might serve the community well and ended up with an organization that largely does citizen science and then interfaces with producers and people in the uplands that also affect water quality.
Sounds very good. Also joining me, Forrest Yonke, the project coordinator for the Crawford Stewardship Project in Crawford County. Forrest, thank you very much for being on Newsmakers today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really happy to be here.
So, Forrest, tell me about the Crawford Stewardship Project. What kind of work do you guys do?
Yeah, so we're based out of Crawford County, but we also work regionally and statewide when we have to. We are focused on sustainable land and water use, local control of natural resources, and environmental justice, which is a very broad mission and takes us into lots of topics from well testing and drinking water quality, surface water quality. We do a lot of hydrogeological education, letting people know how they can best get involved in their local governments and be a part of those decisions being made around them. And also, like Valley Stewardship Network, we do some citizen science and advocating for sustainable and regenerative agriculture in this area.
Tom, you gave us a little bit of an introduction to the Valley Stewardship Network. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about what your organization is involved in?
We are currently, our projects in, we are involved with some farmer-led watershed councils where we're getting producers together. We're not the prime actors. We're facilitators. Those are basically producer-led watershed councils. But we get funding. We go after grant money, get technical assistance, bring in speakers, basically to educate. So we do a lot of education and outreach, sometimes working with elementary school kids, high school kids, getting folks out on the ground and out in the water to see the parameters of water quality, whether it's turbidity and macroinvertebrates or the rest of it. But we started off exclusively in the WAVE program, Protection Volunteers with DNR, and have branched out tremendously into, if you don't talk about the uplands, the area draining into any given watershed, you really don't have much of a grasp of what's going on in the water itself. So we've increasingly gone into the uplands and work with native plantings and the like to improve water quality.
So Tom, when you look at the quality of water in your area, since that is specifically the area of discussion today, what do you see as the biggest threat to that in your community?
We're doing pretty well. We certainly are test for nitrates, test for phosphorus, springtime here with planting and fertilizer applications. We'll see spikes in nitrogen into the water and phosphorus as well. So we're looking at, without trying to get into finger pointing, we're trying to get those that contribute to the problem be really part of the solution and look and see, can you save money by not applying so much nitrogen if it's just going to solubilize and end up in the water? So the getting people educated enough to be more sensitive to the issues. Of course, we do have some problems. We have some CAFOs and the like that are point sources that can be involved in fish kills. And so we We get peripherally involved in those, but because we're trying to keep the discussion going, we try not to make enemies out of those that are a part of the picture. So it's not always easy, certainly not always fun, but if you don't have a dialogue going, it's really hard to make progress. So we try to be big tent.
And for those who are not familiar, you use the term CAFO, which is basically a big agricultural feeding operation, right?
Yes, containment animal feeding operation. Lots of dairies. When anytime it gets over 1,000 animal units, it becomes a CAFO. So yes, there's some of that, and then there's the legislation like it's in the state of Wisconsin right now on hydrologic restoration, and we need to bug our representatives to support that legislation because it looks at the big picture on what's going on locally and statewide with the hydrology. And since we're in karstic country, that's a very unique set of circumstances where groundwater and surface water mix quite readily. So that's a lot of too also what Crawford Stewardship Project does with their sampling and geologic surveys and the like. So
that's Tom Lukens of the Valley Stewardship Network. Also with me today, Forrest Yonke of the Crawford Stewardship Project. Forrest, we were talking a little bit. Tom was talking about some of the things that threaten water quality in the area, and I'm interested to know how individual people can contribute to solutions. Is it advocacy, or are there individual behaviors that people should change in order to preserve the quality of water in your area?
Yeah, certainly. And I think it's not really an either or to that question, but a both. And some of the issues that Tom was talking about with application of nutrients in this area, fertilizers, any kind of chemicals or any even large industrial operations of any sort. It's really a challenge to be as responsible as possible on the kind of landscape we're talking about here in Southwest Wisconsin. Like Tom mentioned, it's a karst landscape. So we have sinkholes and springs and underground rivers here, and all of those are incredible blessings as well and give us our cold water trout streams and some of the amazing biodiverse habitats we have in this area. But there's real challenges in this area with the lack of study. And I think that's one place that we could really use people advocating more for. In the last year or so, we've collaborated with the Vernon, Crawford, and Richland County Health and Conservation Departments to accomplish the Driftless Area Water Study, which was a coordinated well testing campaign with two rounds of tests of just under 400 wells each time. And that's really the first coordinated well testing, groundwater testing that has happened in these three counties, besides some minor individual testing here and there, which that is a great individual action that people can take, is test your well on a regular basis. And really just on all levels, getting involved in local governments and state government when the time comes. Right now is actually an opportune time for people to chime in about the issues they care about at the state level, since the state budget is currently being debated and discussed. So the one virtual hearing just happened today, but there's still a couple more days of public comment and people can submit written suggestions.
So when we're looking at a lot of the things you're talking about and that Tom mentioned earlier, having to do with the application of fertilizers or when a feeding operation reaches a certain size, a lot of these things are really industrial in nature. What needs to happen in terms of communicating or interacting with businesses who are involved in these practices in order to get them to embrace more sustainable environmental practices? Let's start with Forrest on that one.
Yeah, so we talked some about just getting the data and getting the information and being really transparent about that, I think, is very important. So all the surface water testing data that we collect at the sites of concern that we coordinate monitors at, and all the sites that Valley Stewardship Network monitors, that all goes up on the Department of Natural Resources SWIMS database. That's our water quality monitoring database. And that should be informing the decisions that our Department of Natural Resources makes, and can also inform the decisions of individual businesses. And some businesses are very interested in monitoring the streams in their backyards and are active parts of that process. And others, it seems, would rather not know what is going on and feel threatened by the data. And I don't think that anyone should feel threatened by this data. It shouldn't be a political thing. We all have an interest in clean water, and we all drink out of the same aquifer here. Most of us have private wells and are tapping into relatively shallow waters that are not all that old. And so all of the things that we do impact each other, just that if you're on an industrial scale, the impacts are potentially much greater. And so therefore one would expect there's a little bit more regulation, oversight, and things of that nature.
Tom, talking about some of the difficulties here, but let's turn our attention to what is working. What's the most promising effort that you've seen or that you've even been involved in terms of improving water quality or maintaining water quality?
Well, there's producers are increasingly turning to cover crops, to no-till farming practices. These things reduce runoff and surface heating and certainly contribute to improved water quality. Valley Stewardship Network is also promoting prairie strips, tall grass prairie strips that are strategically located to trap nutrients and improve water infiltration. Just native plantings as a whole are good. And so the involvement of landowners at this citizen science level, when people begin to feel comfortable with the indices of water quality, macroinvertebrates, for example, you know, these are all little tiny insect larvae and the like that the presence indicates high water quality, or their absence may indicate that water quality isn't so good. Some critters will only live in low quality water, and so that's what you're looking at. Information is a tool, just like Forrest suggests, transparency and information. And anytime you get a 12-year-old out here and says, how come we don't have these caddisfly larvae and these other critters in our creek, they can go back home and really begin to look at, is it our farming operation? Is it the neighbors? What's makes the difference? And you get people asking questions and thinking. That's a good piece of the battle.
Well, I want to give each of you an opportunity as our conversation comes to a close to give people some means of getting in touch with you and learning more about what you do. Let's start with Tom Lukens from the Valley Stewardship Network. Tom, how can people learn more about the network?
Well, valleystewardshipnetwork.org is that we have a website. It's just www.valleystewardshipnetwork.org. We are training water quality monitors for this year right now. We get some 30, 35 people out in the streams collecting data, feeding them into that SWIMS database that Forrest mentioned. But that's how to get in touch with us. We generally have more workshops, but we're still on the tail end of COVID here, and so we don't have as many in-person workshops. We normally do. Generally, we have at least a dozen a season. Right now, we have the WAVE program and some Zoom meetings going on. But website's got a lot of what we're up to, and I've been writing a book on that website about native plantings and their contribution to biodiversity and my like. So that's where to go.
Sounds interesting. Thank you. And Forrest Yonke from the Crawford Stewardship Project, how can people learn more about your organization?
Yeah, like Tom said, we also have a website. CrawfordStewardship.org. We're on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all those social media. We also put together a community calendar that you can find. We send that out in our mailings. You can find it on our website, and we compile lots of great opportunities to get involved and events, not only our own, but those of many of our allies and other people doing good stewardship work in the region. We've got quite a few things going on this year for the International Year of Caves and Karst 2021. So we're really trying to up our education and outreach on that level by relaunching our Underground World Shadow Puppet Show and trying to show that in some of the local schools. We're created a commissioned book and are drafting artists and authors to make a kids picture book on karst geology and learning about the connections between us and the water and all the different connections there. We also are launching a new water quality monitoring group with North Crawford High School students, which is very exciting. There's a new group called the Swamp Project people in Soldiers Grove working on their local swamp slough there and trying to clean that up and reestablish it as a clean place that it once was. So really, I think a lot of the exciting things going on have to do with all the groups forming and all the people getting involved in their communities and working where their passions align with what they see as their community's greatest need.
That's Forrest Yonke, the program coordinator for Crawford Stewardship Project. Forrest, thank you very much for joining us today on Newsmakers.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Tom Lukens with us as well, the board chair of Valley Stewardship Network. Tom, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. Thanks for asking.
Absolutely. If you'd like to hear this program again or catch another episode you might have missed, you can find it on our website. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. There are a couple of opportunities to hear our show each week. We originate Friday mornings at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3. Then we repeat Friday evenings at 7 o'clock on NPR News and Music 88.9. I'd love to have you listen to us either or maybe both of those times. For Dawn Jewell, my producer, and John Davis, who is always contributing fantastic ideas to this show, and the rest of the Lacrosse crew, thank you very much for listening. And I hope you'll join us again next time for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios, and we are talking today about water quality throughout the show in different aspects. We're starting with an important issue affecting the town of Campbell and the contamination of many wells there, private wells, and a couple of city wells, City of La Crosse wells that have been shut down over the years due to PFAS contamination. That's perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl chemicals that are part of fire retardant foam that's used at the airport and has now leached into groundwater over the years and is affecting many people in the town of Campbell. Joining us today, Lee Donahue, a town of Campbell supervisor. Supervisor Donahue, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also, we have three members of the State Department of Natural Resources from the Office of Emerging Contaminants. We have Mimi Johnson. Mimi, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And from the Drinking and Groundwater Division, Kyle Burton joins us. Kyle, thanks for joining us on Newsmakers.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Jenna Sawyer is with Remediation and Redevelopment at the DNR. Jenna, thanks for being here today.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So let's start with kind of an overview of PFAS, those chemicals. They're called forever chemicals. Mimi, what are those chemicals and why are they such a concern?
PFAS are a family of at least 5,000 different types of chemicals. They show up in food packaging, waterproofing material, firefighting foam. These contaminants have made their way into our environment through accidental spills of PFAS-containing materials, discharges of PFAS-containing wastewater to treatment plants or certain types of firefighting foams. They're often discharged into the environment from industrial or commercial facilities. They're also discharged from military bases, airports, fire stations, or anywhere that might be using the fluorinated firefighting foam. They're also discharged through waste products, including leachate from landfills and biosolids and effluent from wastewater treatment facilities. And the primary transport pathways are through groundwater and through air emissions. And we know that they don't break down in the environment. They've been discovered at concentrations of concern in groundwater, surface water, and drinking water. And people can really be exposed through any of these different ways, and that most of us have some level of PFAS in our body.
It's a huge issue to be concerned about. And it's not just here in the La Crosse area and in the Cooley region, but really it's becoming quite an issue across the state. Jenna, how much of an issue are PFAS in the state? And as the years go on, what's making people more aware of that?
Yeah, sure. We have approximately 45 known PFAS sites. So those are the reported discharge or source areas. So that doesn't reflect really all of the affected properties and the unknown PFAS sites. And I think people are becoming more aware of it because of sites like French Island and sites like Peshtigo and Marinette, and just really PFAS in the news.
Lee Donahue is with us, and she's a resident of the town of Campbell, lives obviously on French Island, and is a member of the Board of Supervisors for the town of Campbell. Lee, talk about when you first started to become aware of this issue in your community.
Sure. So October of last year, we were notified by the then mayor of the city of La Crosse that there was a potential that some of our residential wells may be contaminated with the PFAS. And so that was the first time we found out last October.
It's my understanding, though, that in the city of La Crosse, a couple of wells had been shut down as early as 2016. And so was it an issue of delayed testing, or what do you think was the delay in getting that information, or at least that coming to that understanding in the town of Campbell in terms of people's private wells?
That's a really good question, Ezra. As the town has done quite a bit of research on this issue, we have discovered that there were two wells that belong to the city that are situated within the town of Campbell, situated on French Island. So there are parts of the island that belong to the city of La Crosse. There are parts of the island that belong to the town of Campbell. And two of those municipal wells tested for PFAS as early as 2014, but we were not notified at that point in time.
Is your well one of those? Is your home affected by this?
Absolutely. My neighbors, there have only been two locations that I am aware of that have shown no evidence of PFAS among those that have been tested currently on French Island.
So what does that mean for you on a day-to-day basis? What do you have to do to protect yourself from that?
Well, we have to use an alternate source of water for everything. So if you're boiling noodles, or you're filling up the dog dish, or you're rinsing off your toothbrush, or things that you would normally just turn on the tap and fill up a glass of water, or the coffee pot, or the pet dish, or whatever you're doing, you are so much more aware that when you wash fruits and vegetables that you're using bottled water, and you aren't using tap water that has evidence of PFAS in it.
I've seen over the last couple of weeks different efforts in the community to provide some amount of water to people on French Island. Is that which has been provided enough for your needs, or are you coming out of pocket?
Well, I can tell you that initially the DNR has been a great collaborator with us. We received donations from Quick Trip and also from Hy-Vee for individual cases of bottled water. We actually distributed close to five six semi-truckloads of that water in just a matter of weeks. And while that was going on, the DNR worked with the Department of Health, and a interim water advisory was announced, which allowed the DNR to provide us with not only the small cases of bottled water, but larger 5-gallon jugs of bottled water, which I would say the majority of the residents are using right now.
Kyle Burton is one of our guests from the Department of Natural Resources today. Kyle, what can be done to mitigate the pollution that's in the groundwater, if anything, or what can be done to treat the water that people need to use in their residences?
Whenever we're dealing with contaminated groundwater in remediation cases, our first goal is always to try to remove the contamination from the groundwater or remove the plume of contaminated groundwater. Often in cases like French Island, where there is a large scale, very large area of impacted groundwater, that's not an option. So then we look for how to mitigate the impacts to people through drinking water of the contaminants. So there are generally two buckets that those mitigation steps fall into. One is finding a new safe source of drinking water, and another might be treatment of the drinking water. Common in-home treatments for PFAS include reverse osmosis, which generally is a small unit under the sink which treats a tap, or a larger whole home granular activated carbon filter. It should be noted that any and all in-home treatment systems would require significant maintenance and operational oversight to make sure that they're operating correctly, continue to operate correctly. Finding a new safe source of water is always our goal. It's always our primary goal. It may be possible on the island to drill a deeper well that doesn't draw water contaminated with PFAS. We know at least one or two cases on the island where we have deeper wells that aren't contaminated with PFAS. Though it should be noted that drilling a large amount of new wells through contaminated groundwater to reach a deeper aquifer does present the risk of introducing that contamination to the lower aquifer. So finding a feasible long-term safe source of water, like I said, is our goal. And one option that we have seen employed around the state in cases similar to this with a high density of wells impacted has included some type of community or municipal water system where a community either would obtain a new safe source of water, drill a new well, or partners with an existing municipal water system to deliver water to their customers. In any community-wide solution that might come to fruition, there are many partners that are part of that decision-making process, which could include any or all responsible parties for the contamination that are identified, affected community residents, community leadership, as well as any other potential sources of long-term potable water, such as neighboring communities.
So people are not using this contaminated water to drink. Lee talked about all of the precautions that she has to take to make sure not even using it to clean the food that they're going to eat. What about outdoors? Can you use that water to water your plants, your flowers, your trees? What if it's something growing in your garden that you plan to eat later? Can you use this water to water that?
There's a lot of research about that, Ezra. And one of the resources that I use is a combination of folks between the University of Rhode Island and the Harvard Medical School and a group called STEEP, STEEP. And they routinely do webinars talking about these types of issues. There hasn't been a lot of research to determine what safe amounts of uptake might be, whether it's in leafy vegetables or whether it's in your fruit trees in your backyard and other things. So at this point in time, what we tell our residents is you don't necessarily know how much may or may not be taken up, which is really hard because there are neighbors that that's a big part of their summer. Is their outdoor, you know, backyard gardening. But at this point in time, until we get a better idea of the scope and the extent of the contamination, we're just asking people to err on the side of caution.
Lee, what about the dealings with the airport? I mean, the airport is at this point still required to use the foam that is causing this contamination in the groundwater. What can be done in terms of the town's interaction with the airport to urge them in another direction or to maybe get the FAA to decide something different?
Sure. So there was some legislation last year recognizing the toxicity of that AFFF, the foam that has the PFAS in it, that it is only allowed to be used in a municipal airport. This is not a military airport, but in a municipal airport that is not associated with a military installation, it can only be used in an actual event. And so it can't be used in training. It can't be used in testing. It can only be used in an actual event. What we did earlier this year is that the town of Campbell sent a letter to the city of La Crosse asking that the airport ask the FAA for a waiver to use non-fluorinated foams, which are available. There are non-fluorinated foams that do not have this tight carbon fluorine bond that are available that they can use in the actual event. But we have not heard back from either the airport or the FAA at this point in time.
What has the reaction from the city of La Crosse been to this? Has their response to this been adequate in your experience, Lee?
I can honestly tell you that numerous letters that we have sent to the city of La Crosse have not been responded to.
Are you hopeful that you might have a different response given a new administration coming into power in La Crosse?
We are always hopeful. We are always hopeful to have a more collaborative effort moving forward. And we hope that will come to fruition.
What kind of interaction have you had with your representatives on the state level in terms of possible legislative action? I know yesterday's action, this week's action of the legislature that would make it pretty difficult to implement a newly proposed PFAS rule must have been a disappointment to you.
There are a lot of disappointments in regard to PFAS and the ability for the DNR to do their job to regulate our water for safe drinking water for every resident in the state of Wisconsin. I work daily, weekly, monthly, not only with our local legislators and our state legislators, but also with those at the federal level as well. So it's a constant collaboration. One of the biggest issues that we will certainly find ourselves in is who's going to finance the long-term solution. We are a small town. We are approximately 4 square miles, so we're pretty little. And so how are we going to finance a long-term solution for a problem that we didn't create? Budgetarily, it's not something that would normally fit into our annual budget. So
I don't know which of our guests from the DNR would be the best person to pose this question to. Maybe Mimi, I'll start with you, and if you have a different suggestion, we can roll with that. But what is being done on a DNR level, on a state level, to either get people hooked up with safer sources of drinking water by means of, like, you know, buying bottled water versus like finding new groundwater? What is the DNR doing on a regular basis to help accommodate the needs of those residents?
I'm going to turn that one over to Jenna, but first I just want to build off of what Lee was just saying in terms of the need for local communities to have resources to really address this problem. And the governor's budget and the recently unveiled CLEAR Act both really invest in and support communities, recognizing that this is such a financial burden to them, with more than $20 million in grants to local communities to help do the investigation, provide water, work towards long-term solutions.
Jenna, did you want to take a stab at what the state level reaction is toward this issue?
Sure. So the DNR is currently working to provide everyone on the island with, as Lee said, the 5-gallon jugs and dispensers for the interim area-wide advisory so that they have emergency water right now while we figure out a longer-term water solution. And currently we have about 960 residences signed up for that service, and that will continue through the interim area-wide advisory that DHS has issued. In addition, the DNR has contracted with an environmental consultant to do additional sampling of private wells. So the city, as well as individual residences, have sampled approximately 200 wells to date that we've received results for. And the DNR is also doing additional sampling of about 200 wells to sort of fill in that data gap to really see a more complete picture of the PFAS across the island. So we're trying to address the immediate issue of getting people safe water, as well as trying to gather more data to figure out a longer term solution.
And Ezra, I'll just pipe back to that really quickly. The governor's goal for that biennial budget is a great move in the right direction, because we know that we have PFAS contamination in drinking water. And I believe Mimi said earlier, there are at least 35 known sites across the state. But if you stop to consider, depending upon each individual community situation, to either stand up an individual water utility or to provide all of the piping to hook up to another municipal water facility is anywhere upwards of $50 to $70 million for a lot of communities. The $20 million, even though it's a great goal and it's better than anything that we've ever had, that would quickly be divided by 35 communities.
Lee Donahue is a supervisor in the town of Campbell. Lee, thank you very much for sharing your perspective with us today.
You bet.
Our guests from the DNR have been Mimi Johnson, Kyle Burton, and Jenna Sawyer. Thank you all for joining us as well.
Thank you for having us.
And this is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to hear the program again, if there's part of it you missed, or if you want to check out a previous episode, you can find all of them on our website. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. The show continues in just a moment. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios on the campus of the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. So pleased to be joined today by Mayor Mitch Reynolds of La Crosse. It's our first conversation since he has assumed office. We, of course, talked to him during the political season. Mayor Reynolds, thank you for joining me today on Newsmakers.
Well, thanks, Ezra. It's a pleasure being here. Appreciate it.
The subject matter is a dense pile of difficulty to jump into in your first weeks as mayor, but it's this PFAS issue, the perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl chemicals that are causing drinking water problems out on French Island in the town of Campbell. And so just as you're getting used to the office, it's your first couple of weeks on the job. What is the city's role going to be as you take office, helping the town of Campbell get to a better source of clean drinking water?
Well, thanks, Ezra. And let me just say that it's interesting because although this is one of the issues that I certainly am facing every day as a challenge, there's a whole bunch of others that we have to address as well within the city of La Crosse. So I wish I could spend all of my time just focusing on one issue, there's multiple things that we have to address that go well beyond this, but that definitely is getting a daily attention from me. And among the things that we're doing is making sure that we're following through on the commitments from all of our partners in this, including the DNR and the EPA and the FAA and other state agencies, DHS, and others in relation to making sure that we're doing the best testing and the best data gathering and the best data analysis.
There's been testing that's going on mostly, from what I understand, downriver from where the contamination is. But how often is that testing done? Is it a one-and-done thing, or is there a reason to have ongoing testing on those properties?
Ezra, those are really good questions. As not the scientist in the bunch, I guess I can't with a great deal of certainty really answer that question. I don't know how much testing, additional testing would need to be done on specific wells. I don't really know that. I know that, you know, we have to make sure that we have testing that is done well. And I know that that's maybe not always the case. We also have to make sure that the labs that are evaluating the test samples are certified to do that. And I'm not sure if that's been the case. So I think that that's part of the evaluation process of the tests that we've gotten from Wells, but I don't know who will need another test or if there will be more tests. I guess I really don't have the answers to those questions.
What about something like, I don't even know how feasible this would be, but providing city water services to Town of Campbell residents, would that be something that's possible? And what would have to go into those that kind of deal? Obviously, there'd have to be some kind of understanding between the city and the township.
Yeah, there would. There would have to be an understanding. There would have to be, you know, and it's a formalized agreement, obviously. You know, those conversations about how additional water is provided to the Town of Campbell, or whether the Town of Campbell wants city water, or whether the Town of Campbell provides its own water in some other kind of way at some point, those are all very, very preliminary. And, you know, again, Ezra, this is a long-term project that involves a long period of time of really evaluating the situation. I know that for those people who feel that they have to have bottled water right now, this is certainly not ideal for them. It's pretty awful, I would imagine. But it's not something we can't jump into solutions that may be ineffective. And we're not at the point where we are providing remediation or mitigation, and we have not begun any conversations yet with the Town of Campbell about providing water. To my knowledge, and again, just to be clear, I've been on the job for 9 days. And so I have not been approached in any kind of way about from the Town of Campbell about providing water to anybody out there in terms of city services. So it would be really peremptory of me to begin those conversations with you when I certainly haven't had those conversations with them.
Fair enough. La Crosse, the city is involved in a lawsuit which came before the beginning of your term, obviously, against the various chemical companies involved in producing this foam that's used and is now leaching into the groundwater out there by the airport. Recoup costs related to mitigation from that, or what about covering some of these initiatives that could provide better drinking water and a more secure source of that for residents of the Town of Campbell? Are you hopeful that the lawsuit might help ease some of those burdens?
You know, our primary goal with these suits are to hold the manufacturers accountable. There's basically a couple dozen, but these are manufacturers who have been aware for years about the impacts of the health impacts of the chemicals that are used, not only in this firefighting foam, but in other things as well. They knew for years, before that was ever public information. In fact, they willfully hid that from the public and from those organizations like fire departments who were using this foam. And other chemicals like it. So what we're trying to do, and again, it's remarkable that communities such as ours have to go out on our own and try to hold these big manufacturers accountable when there are communities all over the United States that are facing the same dilemma, right here in Wisconsin, as a matter of fact, a few dozen right here in Wisconsin that are facing the same issues. And we're all basically trying to tackle the situation all on our own, without really any significant help from the state or the federal government, which is largely, especially the FAA, the federal government is largely where the responsibility, at least for firefighting foam, lies. So again, what we're trying to do is hold these manufacturers responsible for not only the chemicals, the detriment that these chemicals have caused our people and our communities, but also for lying about it and hiding the truth from our people for so long. And I just, you know, I think that will there be a financial settlement? I guess I really don't know, but we have to at least make the attempt at holding them responsible, because we have to remember the city of La Crosse is also a victim here. We have multiple wells that have traces of PFAS in them. You know, we're also trying to recover some of the costs that we're going to be incurring for making those wells whole as well. So you know, it's about holding responsibility. Yeah, we need help in paying for whatever, however long this goes and whatever road we go down, we definitely will need help doing that. And if holding manufacturers responsible is a way to do that, then that's what we'll do.
You mentioned the legislature earlier, state government. Just this week, the legislature basically shelved an attempt from the governor's office to create some rules around PFAS that could have supporters of the rules say that it would have made it easier to get a hold on moving this issue in the right direction in terms of groundwater contamination. And the legislature basically took action that sets those rules on the shelf. Are you able to be, again, 9 days in office, right? Maybe this isn't even a fair question, but have you been in touch with any of our local people who represent the state, us yeah, to the state?
Absolutely. Our partners, the Representative Jill Billings, the State Senator Brad Papp, have been extraordinary about reaching out and having conversations with me for us to try to collaborate. I mean, they're as frustrated as I am about the move by the Republican lawmakers to do away with testing and to remove any liability from manufacturers or businesses in order to stop testing for PFAS. You know, what you see here, Ezra, is the mighty power of the Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce at play. You know, that's who's really calling the shots on this one. And it is incredibly frustrating. It's not only for me, but for, like you said, our local state lawmakers as well, that this seems like such an obvious move to make for the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, we have a big business lobby that's basically getting in the way because they do not want to be held responsible, and they do not want these chemicals to be tested for. And then they do not want there to be any sort of standard that anybody has to adhere to, or that that would prevent, I guess, the further distribution of these chemicals. I mean, you know, it's incredibly frustrating, but I'm working right alongside Representative Jill Billings and State Senator Brad Papp. I'm working right alongside them with them to come to some solution. So I know the governor was here just the other day talking about some other potential solutions, but you know, this is going to be a really, really big problem for the state in many communities, not just our own. And it's going to take some significant work by not just the governor on his own, but state lawmakers as well. And to this point, the majority in Madison doesn't seem willing to help.
A long row to hoe, for sure, as you begin this undertaking, at least your part in this undertaking. What do you see as the best way forward?
Well, we have to continue the path that we have in front of us right now. There's not a magic process for, you know, ending this overnight. This is a process that's going to take a while. Like I mentioned before, we haven't even gotten through the testing aspect yet. We have a report that's in front of the DNR that we put considerable resources. We spent considerable city resources in a time when we can't afford it, hiring a specialist to help us evaluate and help us address the issues that are on French Island. So we have a report from our consultant that is in front of the DNR. And they're essentially sitting on it for weeks until they can wrap their minds around it. I don't know what the process is, honestly, but and that's them holding on to our report that we've created so far. And again, that's a weeks long process, but there's still more testing to be done and there's still more analysis to be done. And, you know, we still are just getting funding going in the state labs. So we have to just continue step-by-step process. I wish there was some magical way, again, that we could just simply fix everything, but we can't. We don't have the resources to do that without knowing the scope of the problem, at least. And we just simply, nobody really has a good sense of that at this point. You know, we have a widespread hits of these chemicals throughout French Island, in our city wells and in other wells. And we just, there's just not a great concept of how far it is, where it is, and the concentrations at this point.
Lacrosse Mayor Mitch Reynolds, first couple weeks in office and already diving headlong into this issue affecting some of our neighbors. And Mr. Mayor, I appreciate your time on the show today.
Well, thank you, Ezra. I really appreciate you having me on. And let's have a talk again soon.
It's Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to check out more of our conversation, including our previous conversation with a resident from the town of Campbell and folks from the DNR, you can find it all on our website. It's wpr.org/newsmakers. Our program continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio.